Chapter 98. The National Socialist Party did not tolerate secret societies because it was itself a secret society with its grand master, its racist gnosis, its rites and initiations. René Allot, Les Sources Occultes du Nazisme, Paris, Grasset, 1969, page 214. It was around this time that Allier slipped through our fingers. That was the expression Belbo used, with a tone of excessive indifference. I attributed the indifference once again to jealousy. Silently obsessed by Allier's power over Lorenza, aloud he wisecracked about the power Allier was gaining at Garamond. Perhaps it was our own fault. Allier had begun seducing Garamond almost a year earlier, from the time of the alchemistic party in Piedmont. Soon after that, Garamond entrusted the SFA file to him, for him to recruit new victims to flesh out the ISIS Unveiled catalog. By now, Garamond consulted him on every decision, and no doubt gave him a monthly check. Gudrun, who carried out periodic expeditions to the end of the corridor, and beyond the glass door that gave access to the padded world of Minucius, told us from time to time in a worried voice that Allier had practically established himself in the office of Signora Grazia. He dictated letters to her, escorted new visitors into Garamond's office, and in short, and here Gudrun's indignation robbed her of even more vowels, acted as if he owned the place. We really should have wondered why Allier spent hours and hours on the Minucius address file. Selecting the SFAs to invite to join the list of authors for ISIS Unveiled should not have taken that much time. Yet he went on writing, contacting, making appointments. But we actually fostered his autonomy. The situation suited Belbo. More Allier in Via Marchese Gualdi meant less Allier in Via Sincero Renato. Thus, when Lorenza Pellegrini made one of her sudden appearances and Belbo, with unconcealed excitement, became pathetically radiant, there was less likelihood that Simon would barge in ruinously. I wasn't displeased, either, since by now I had lost interest in ISIS Unveiled and more involved in my history of magic. Feeling I had learned from the diabolicals everything there was to learn, I let Allier handle the contacts and contracts with the new authors. Nor did Diotelevi object. In general, the world seemed to matter less and less to him. Now that I think back, I realize that he continued losing weight in a troubling way. At times I would see him in his office bent over a manuscript, his eyes vacant, his pen about to drop from his hand. He wasn't asleep, he was exhausted. There was another reason we accepted the increasing rarity of Allier's appearances and their brevity, for he would simply hand back to us the manuscripts he had rejected, then vanish into the corridor. The fact was, we didn't want him to hear our discussions. If anyone had asked us why, we would have said it was out of delicacy or embarrassment, since we were parodying the metaphysics in which he somehow believed. But it was really distrust on our part. We were slowly assuming the natural reserve of those who possess a secret, and we were putting Allier in the role of the profane masses as we took more and more seriously the thing we had invented. Perhaps, too, as Diotelevi said in a moment of good humor, now that we had a real Saint-Germain, we didn't need an imitation. Allier didn't seem to take offense at our reserve. He would greet us, then leave us, with a politeness that bordered on hauteur. One Monday morning I arrived at work late, and Belbo eagerly asked me to come to his office, calling Diotelevi too. "Big news," he said. But before he could begin, Lorenza arrived. Belbo was torn between his joy at this visit and his impatience to tell what he had discovered. A moment later there was a knock, and Allier stuck his head in. "I don't want to disturb you. Please don't get up. I haven't the authority to intrude on such a consistory. I only wanted to tell our dearest Lorenza that I'm in Signor Garamond's office, and I hope I have at least the authority to summon her for a sherry at noon in my office." In his office? This time Belbo lost self-control, to the extent, that is, that he could lose it. He waited for Allier to leave, then muttered through clenched teeth, "Magatte lanata." Lorenza, still showing her pleasure at the invitation, asked Belbo what that meant. "It's Turin dialect. It means literally be so kind as to remove the cork. A pompous, self-important, overweening individual is thought to hold himself the way he does because of a cork stuck in his sphincter ani, which prevents his vaporific dignity from being dispersed. The removal of the cork causes the individual to deflate, a process usually accompanied by a shrill whistle and the reduction of the outer envelope to a poor, fleshless phantom of its former self." "I didn't know you could be so vulgar." "Now you know." Lorenza went out, pretending to be annoyed. I knew this distressed Belbo all the more. Real anger would have reassured him, but a pretense of irritation only confirmed his fear that, from Lorenza, the display of any passion was always staged, theatrical. He said then, with grim determination, "To business," meaning, "Let's proceed with the plan, seriously." "I don't much want to," Theotilevi said. "I don't feel well. I have a pain here." He touched his stomach. "I think it's gastritis." "Ridiculous," Belbo said to him. "I don't have gastritis. What could give you gastritis, mineral water?" "Could be," Theotilevi said with a wan smile. "Last night I overdid it. I'm accustomed to still fuji, and I drank some fizzy San Pellegrino." "You must be careful. Such excesses could kill you. But to business, gentlemen. I've been dying to tell you for 2 days now. Finally, I know why the 36 Invisibles were unable for centuries to work out the form of the map. John D. got it wrong. The geography has to be done over. We live inside a hollow earth, enclosed by the terrestrial surface. Hitler realized this." Chapter 99. Nazism was the moment when the spirit of magic seized the helm of material progress. Lenin said communism was socialism plus electricity. In a sense, Hitlerism was Geninism plus armored divisions. Fauvels and Bergier, Le Matin des Magiciens, Paris, Gallimard, 1960, 2, Roman 7. Now Belbo had managed to work Hitler into the plan. "It's all there, black on white. The founders of Nazism were involved in Teutonic Neo-Templarism." "Oh, an airtight case." "I'm not inventing, Kasavin. For once, I'm not inventing." "Take it easy. When did we ever invent anything? We've always started with objective data, with information in the public domain." "This time, too. In 1912, a Germanenorden group is formed, proposing the tenet of Aryan superiority. In 1918, a certain Baron von Zabotendorf founds a related group, the Thule Gesellschaft, a secret society, yet another variation on the Templar strict observance, but with strong racist pan-German neo-Aryan tendencies. And in 1933, Zabotendorf writes that he had sown what Hitler reaped. Furthermore, it is in Thule Gesellschaft circles that the Hooked Cross appears. And who was among the first to join the Thule? Rudolf Hess, Hitler's evil genius. Then Rosenberg. Then Hitler himself. And note that in his cell in Spandau, even today, as you've surely read in the papers, Hess studies the esoteric sciences. Zabotendorf, in 24, writes a pamphlet on alchemy and remarks that the first experiments in atomic fission demonstrate the truths of the great work. He also writes a novel on the Rosicrucians. Later, he edits an astrological magazine, Astrologische Rundschau, and Trevor Roper tells us that the Nazi chiefs, Hitler first among them, never made a move without having a horoscope cast. In 1943, a group of psychics is consulted to discover where Mussolini is being held prisoner. In other words, the whole Nazi leadership is connected with Teutonic neo-occultism. Belbo seemed to have got over the incident with Lorenza, and I built a fire under him to get on with his theory. "We can look at Hitler's power as a rabble-rouser also from this point of view," I said. "Physically, he was a toad. He had a shrill voice. How could such a man whip crowds into a frenzy? He must have possessed psychic powers. Perhaps, instructed by some druid from his hometown, he knew how to establish contact with the subterranean currents. Perhaps he was a living valve, a biological menhir, transmitting the currents to the faithful in the Nuremberg Stadium. For a while it worked for him, then his batteries ran down." Chapter 100. To all the world, I declare the earth is hollow and habitable within, containing a number of solid concentric spheres, one within the other, and that it is open at the poles 12 or 16 degrees. J. Cleves Sims of Ohio, late Captain of Infantry, April 10, 1818, quoted in Sprague de Camp and Lay, Lands Beyond, New York, Reinhardt, 1952, Roman 10. Congratulations, Kasavin. In your innocence, you hit upon the truth. Hitler's one genuine obsession was the underground currents. He believed in the theory of the hollow earth. Holwertlehre. I'm leaving. I've got gastritis, Theotilevi said. Wait, we're getting to the best part. The earth is hollow. We don't live outside it, on the convex crust, but inside, on the concave surface. What we think is the sky is actually a gaseous mass, with points of brilliant light which fills the interior of our globe. All astronomical measurements have to be reinterpreted. The sky is not infinite, it's circumscribed. The sun, if it really exists, is no bigger than it looks, a mere crumb having a diameter of 30 centimeters at the center of the earth. The Greeks had already suspected as much.
You made this up, Diotalevi said wearily.
I did not. Somebody had the idea at the beginning of the last century, an American, a man named Sims. Then, at the end of the century, another American, name of Teed, revived the notion, supported by alchemistic experiments and a reading of Isaiah. After the First World War, the hollow earth theory was perfected by a German, I forget his name, who founded the Hohlweltlehrer movement. Hitler and his cronies discovered that Hohlweltlehrer corresponded exactly to their principles, and they even, according to one report, misaimed some of the V1s because they calculated their trajectories on the basis of a concave, not a convex surface. Hitler at this point was convinced that the king of the world was himself, and that the Nazi general staff members were the unknown superiors. Where does the king of the world live? Beneath, not above. This hypothesis inspired Hitler to change the whole direction of German research toward the concept of the final map, the interpretation of the pendulum. The Six Templar groups had to be reassembled. Everything had to be begun again from the beginning. Consider the logic of Hitler's conquests. First, Danzig, to have under his control the classical places of the Teutonic group. Next, he conquered Paris to get his hands on the pendulum and the Eiffel Tower, and he contacted the synarchic groups and put them into the Vichy government. Then he made sure of the neutrality, in effect the cooperation, of the Portuguese group. His fourth objective was, of course, England, but we know that wasn't easy. Meanwhile, with the African campaigns, he tried to reach Palestine, but here again he failed. Then he aimed at the dominion of the Paulician territories by invading the Balkans and Russia. When Hitler had 4/6 of the plan in his hands, he sent Hess on a secret mission to England to propose an alliance. The Baconians, however, refused. He had another idea. Those who were holding the most important part of the secret must be his eternal enemies, the Jews. He didn't look for them in Jerusalem, where few were left. The Jerusalemites group's piece of the message wasn't in Palestine anyway. It was in the possession of a group of the diaspora. And so the Holocaust is explained.
How is that?
Just think for a moment. Suppose you wanted to commit genocide.
Excuse me, Diotalevi said, but this is going too far. My stomach hurts. I'm going home.
Wait, damn it. When the Templars were disemboweling the Saracens, you enjoyed yourself because it was so long ago. Now you're being delicate like a petty intellectual. We're remaking history. We can't be squeamish.
We let him continue, subdued by his vehemence.
The striking thing about the genocide of the Jews is the lengthiness of the procedures. First they're kept in camps and starved, then they're stripped naked, then the showers, then the scrupulous piling up of the corpses, and the sorting and storing of clothes, the listing of personal effects. None of this makes sense if it was just a question of killing them. It makes sense if it was a question of looking for something, for a message that one of those millions of people, the Jerusalemite representative of the 36 Invisibles, was hiding in the hem of a garment or in his mouth, or had tattooed on his body. Only the plan explains the inexplicable bureaucracy of the genocide. Hitler was searching the Jews for the clue that would allow him to determine, with the pendulum, the exact point under the earth's concave vault where the telluric currents converged. And now you see the beauty of the idea. The telluric currents became equated with the celestial currents. The hollow earth theory gives new life to the age-old hermetic intuition, namely that what lies beneath is equal to what lies above. The mystic pole coincides with the heart of the earth. The secret pattern of the stars is nothing other than the secret pattern of the subterranean passages of Agartha. There is no longer any difference between heaven and hell, and the Grail, the lapis exilis, is the lapis ex coelis, the philosopher's stone, the terminal, the limit, the Thonian uterus of the Empyrean. And if Hitler can identify that point in the hollow center of the earth, which is also the exact center of the sky, he will be master of the world, whose king he is by right of race. And that's why, to the very end, in the depths of his bunker, he thought he could still control the mystic pole.
Stop, Diotalevi said. Enough is enough. I'm sick.
He's really sick. It's not an ideological protest, I said. Belbo finally understood.
Concerned, he went to Diotalevi, who was leaning against the desk, apparently on the verge of fainting.
"Sorry, my friend, I got carried away. You're sure it's not anything I said? We've joked together for 20 years, you and I. Maybe you do have gastritis. Look, try a Marincol tablet and a hot water bottle. Come, I'll drive you home. Then you'd better call a doctor, have yourself looked at."
Diotalevi said he could take a taxi home. He wasn't at death's door yet. He just had to lie down. Yes, he would call a doctor, he promised. And it wasn't the Holocaust business that had upset him. He had been feeling bad since the previous evening.
Belbo, relieved, went with him to the taxi.
When he came back, he looked worried. "Now that I think about it, Diotalevi hasn't been himself for several weeks. Those circles under his eyes. It's not fair. I should have died of cirrhosis 10 years ago, and here I am, the picture of health, whereas he lives like an ascetic and has gastritis or maybe worse. If you ask me, it's an ulcer. To hell with the plan. We're not living right."
"A Marincol will fix him up," I said.
"Yes, and a hot water bottle on his stomach. Let's hope he acts sensibly."
Chapter 101. Qui operatur in cabala, si erabit in opere aut non purificatus accessorit, deu erabitur ab Azazele. Pico della Mirandola, Conclusionis Magicae.
Diotalevi's condition took a decided turn for the worse in late November. He called the office to say he was going into the hospital. The doctor had told him there was nothing to worry about, but it would be a good idea to have some tests. Belbo and I somehow connected Diotalevi's illness with the plan, which perhaps we had carried too far. It was irrational, but we felt guilty. This was the second time I seemed to be Belbo's partner in crime. Once, we had remained silent together, withholding information from De Angelis. And now we had talked too much. We told each other this was silly, but we couldn't shake off our uneasiness. And so, for a month or more, we did not discuss the plan. Meanwhile, after he had been out for 2 weeks or so, Diotalevi dropped by to tell us in a nonchalant tone that he had asked Garamond for sick leave. A treatment had been recommended to him. He didn't go into details, but it involved his reporting to the hospital every 2 or 3 days, and it would leave him somewhat weak. I didn't see how he could get much weaker. His face now was as white as his hair.
"And forget about those stories," he said. "They're bad for the health, as you'll see. It's the Rosicrucians' revenge."
"Don't worry," Belbo said to him, smiling. "We'll make life really unpleasant for those Rosicrucians, and they'll leave you alone. Nothing to it." And he snapped his fingers. The treatment lasted until the beginning of the new year. I was absorbed by my history of magic. The real thing, serious stuff, I said to myself, not our nonsense. Garamond came by at least once a day to ask for news of Diotalevi. "And please, gentlemen, let me know if any need arises, any problem, any circumstance in which I, the firm, can do something for our admirable friend. For me, he's like a son, more, a brother. And thank heaven this is a civilized country, whatever people may say. We have a public health system we can be proud of."
Allier expressed concern, asked for the name of the hospital, and telephoned its director, a dear friend, who moreover happened to be the brother of an SFA with whom Allier was on excellent terms. Diotalevi would be treated with special consideration.
Lorenza showed up often to ask for news. This should have made Belbo happy, but he took it as another indication that his prognosis was not good. Lorenza was there, but still elusive, because she wasn't there for him. Shortly before Christmas, I'd caught a snatch of their conversation. Lorenza was saying to him, "The snow is just right, and they have charming little rooms. You can do cross-country skiing, can't you?" I concluded that they would be spending New Year's Eve together. But one day after Epiphany, when Lorenza appeared in the corridor, Belbo said to her, "Happy New Year," and dodged her attempt to give him a hug.
Chapter 102. Leaving this place, we came to a settlement known as Milestre, where it is said that one known as the Old Man of the Mountain dwelled. And he built, over high mountains surrounding a valley, a very thick and high wall, in a circuit of 30 miles, and it was entered by 2 doors, and they were hidden, cut into the mountain. Odorico da Pordenone, de rebus incognitis, impressus Esauri, 1513, Roman 21, page 15.
One day at the end of January, as I was walking along Via Marchese Gualdi, where I had parked my car, I saw Salon coming out of Minutius. "A little chat with my friend Allier," he said to me. Friend? As I seemed to recall from the Piedmont party, Allier was not fond of him. Was Salon snooping around Minutius, or was Allier using him for some contact or other? Salon didn't give me time to ponder this. He suggested a drink, and we ended up at Pilade's. I had never seen Salon in this part of town, but he greeted old Pilade as if they had known each other for years. We sat down. He asked me how my history of magic was progressing. So he knew about that, too. I prodded him about the Hollow Earth theory and about Sebattendorf, the man Belbo had mentioned. He laughed. "You people certainly draw your share of madmen. I'm not familiar with this business of the earth being hollow. As for Sebattendorf, now there was a character. He gave Himmler and company some ideas that were suicidal for the German people." "What ideas?" "Oriental fancies. That man, wary of the Jews, ended up worshipping the Arabs and the Turks. Did you know that on Himmler's desk, along with Mein Kampf, there was always the Koran? Sebattendorf, fascinated in his youth by an occult Turkish sect, began studying Islamic Gnosis. He said Führer, but thought Old Man of the Mountain. When they all got together and founded the SS, they had in mind an organization like the Assassins. Ask yourself why Germany and Turkey in the First World War were allies." "How do you know these things?" "I told you, I think, that my poor father worked for the Okhrana. Well, I remember in those days how the Tsarist police were concerned about the Assassins. Rakovsky got wind of it first, but they gave up that trail because if the Assassins were involved, then the Jews couldn't be, and the Jews were the danger. As always, the Jews went back to Palestine and made those others leave their caves. But the whole thing is complicated, confused. Let's leave it at that." He seemed to regret having said so much and hastily took his leave. Then another thing happened. I'm now sure I didn't dream it, but that day I thought it was a hallucination. As I watched Salon walk away from the bar, I saw him meet a man at the corner, an Oriental. In any case, Salon had said enough to start my imagination working again. The Old Man of the Mountain and the Assassins were no strangers to me. I had mentioned them in my thesis. The Templars were accused of being in collusion with them. How could we have overlooked this? So I began exercising my mind again and my fingertips, going through old card files, and an idea came to me, an idea so spectacular that I couldn't restrain myself. The next morning I burst into Belbo's office. "They got it all wrong. We got it all wrong." "Take it easy, Kasabin. What are you talking about?" "Oh my God, the plan." Then he hesitated. "You probably don't know. There's bad news about Diotelevi. He won't speak. I called the hospital, but they refused to give me the particulars because I'm not a relative. The man doesn't have any relatives, so who is there to act on his behalf? I don't like this reticence. A benign growth, they say, but the therapy wasn't enough. He should go back into the hospital for a month or so, and minor surgery may be indicated. In other words, those people aren't telling me the whole story, and I like this situation less and less." I didn't know what to say. Embarrassed by my triumphal entry, I started leaping through papers, but Belbo couldn't resist. He was like a gambler who's been shown a pack of cards. "Oh, what the hell," he said. "Life goes on, unfortunately. What did you find?" "Well, Hitler goes to all that trouble with the Jews, but he accomplishes nothing. Occultists throughout the world for centuries have studied Hebrew, rummaged in Hebrew texts, and at most they can draw a horoscope. Why?" "Because the Jerusalemites fragment of the message is still hidden somewhere, though the Paulicians fragment never turned up either, as far as we know." "That's an answer worthy of Allier, not of us. I have a better one. The Jews have nothing to do with it." "What do you mean?" "The Jews have nothing to do with the plan. They can't. Picture the situation of the Templars, first in Jerusalem, then in their commanderies in Europe. The French knights meet the Germans, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Italians, the English. They all have contacts with the Byzantine area, and in particular, they combat the Turk, an adversary with whom they fight but also maintain a gentlemanly relationship, a relationship of equals. Who were the Jews at that time in Palestine? A religious and racial minority, tolerated by the condescending Arabs, but treated very badly by the Christians. We must remember that in the course of the various crusades, the ghettos were sacked as a matter of course, and there were massacres all around. Is it conceivable that the Templars, snobs that they were, would exchange mystical information with the Jews? Never. And in the European commanderies, the Jews were considered usurers, were despised, people to be exploited, not trusted. We're talking about an alliance of knights, about a spiritual knighthood. Would the Templars of Provence allow second-class citizens to join that? Out of the question.
But what about all that Renaissance magic, the study of Kabbalah?
Well, that was only natural. By then we're close to the third meeting. They're champing at the bit, looking for shortcuts. Hebrew is a sacred and mysterious language. The Kabbalists have been busy on their own and to other ends. The 36 scattered around the world got the idea that a mysterious language might conceal God knows what secrets. It was Pico della Mirandola who said that nulla nomina ut significativa et in quantum nomina sunt, in magico opere virtutum habere non possunt. Nisi sint hebraica. Pico della Mirandola was a Cretan.
Bravo, now you're talking.
Furthermore, as an Italian, he was excluded from the plan. What did he know? So much the worse for Agrippa, Reuchlin, and their pals who fell for that red herring. I'm reconstructing the story of a red herring, a false trail. Is that clear? We let ourselves be influenced by Diotelevi, who was always cabalizing. He cabalized, so we put the Jews in the plan. If he had been a scholar of Chinese culture, would we have put the Chinese in the plan?
Maybe we would have.
Anyway, let's not rend our garments. We were led astray by everyone. They all, from Postel on, probably made this mistake. 200 years after Provins, they were convinced that the sixth group was the Jerusalemites. It wasn't.
Look, Kasaban, we were the ones who revised Ardenti's theory. We were the ones who said that the appointment of the rock didn't mean Stonehenge, but the rock in the Mosque of Omar.
And we were wrong. There are other rocks. We should have thought of a place founded on rock, on a mountain, a stone, a spur, a cliff. The sixth group awaits in the fortress of Alamut.
Chapter 103.
And Kairos appeared, holding in his hand a scepter that signified royalty, and he gave it to the first created god, and he took it and said, Your secret name shall have 36 letters. Hassana Sabah, Sargasash de Sayidna. A bravura performance, but now explanations were in order. I provided them in the days that followed. Long explanations, detailed, documented. On a table at Pilades, I showed Belbo proof after proof, which he followed with increasingly glazed eyes while he chain-smoked and every 5 minutes held out his empty glass, the ghost of an ice cube at the bottom, and Pilade would hasten to refill it without waiting to be told. My first sources were the same ones in which the earliest accounts of the Templars appeared, from Gerard of Strasbourg to Joinville. The Templars had come into contact, into conflict sometimes, but more often into mysterious alliance, with the assassins of the Old Man of the Mountain. The story was complicated and began after the death of Muhammad, with the schism between the followers of the ordinary law, the Sunnis, and the supporters of Ali, the Prophet's son-in-law, Fatima's husband, who saw the succession taken from him. It was the enthusiasts of Ali, the group of adepts called the Shiites, who created the heretic branch of Islam, the Shia, an occult doctrine which saw the continuity of the revelation not in traditional meditation upon the words of the Prophet, but in the very person of the Imam, Lord, Leader, Epiphany of the Divine, Theophanic Reality, King of the World. Now, what happened to this heretic Islamic branch, which was gradually infiltrated by all the esoteric doctrines of the Mediterranean basin, from Manichaeanism to Gnosticism, from Neoplatonism to Iranian mysticism, by all those impulses whose shifts in development in the West we had followed for years? It was a long story, impossible to unravel, partly because the various Arab authors and protagonists had extremely long names. The texts were transcribed with a forest of diacritical marks, and as the evening wore on, we could no longer distinguish between Abu Abdallah Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Razam al-Tay al-Kufi, Abu Muhammad Ubaidallah, and Abu Muini Abdin Nasir ibn Kusra Marvazi Kubadayani. But an Arab, I imagine, would have the same difficulty with Aristotle, Aristoxenus, Aristarchus, Aristides, Aristagoras, Anaximander, Anaximenes, Anacreon, and Anacharsis. But one thing was certain. Shiism in turn split into two branches, one called the Twelvers, who await a lost and future imam, and the other, the Ismailis, born in the realm of the Fatimids in Cairo, who subsequently gave rise to reformed Ismailism in Persia through a fascinating figure, the mystical and ferocious Hassanah Sabah. Sabah set up his headquarters to the southwest of the Caspian, in the impregnable fortress of Alamut, the nest of the raptor. There, Sabah surrounded himself with his devotees, the Fediyin, those faithful unto death, and he used them to carry out his political assassinations, to be instruments of the Jihad Hafi, the secret holy war. The Fediyin later gained an unfortunate reputation under the name Assassins. Not a lovely word now, but for them it was splendid, the emblem of a race of warrior monks who greatly resembled the Templars, a spiritual knighthood. The fortress or castle of Alamut, the rock, built on an airy crest 400 meters long and in places only a few meters wide, 30 at most. From the distance, to one arriving along the Azerbaijan road, it looked like a natural wall, dazzling white in the sun, bluish in the purple dusk, bloody at dawn. On Sundays it blended with the clouds or flashed with lightning. Along its upper ridge you could just make out what seemed a row of flint swords that shot upward for hundreds of meters. The most accessible side was a treacherous slope of gravel, which archaeologists even today are unable to scale. The fortress was reached by a secret stairway bitten out of the rock, like the spiral peel of a stone apple, and a single archer could defend it. Dizzying, a world elsewhere, Alamut could be reached only astride eagles. Here Sabah ruled, and his successors after him, each to be known as the Old Man of the Mountain. First of them was the sulphurous Sinan. Sabah had invented a method of dominion over his men, and to his adversaries he declared that if they did not submit to him, they would die. There was no escaping the assassins. Nizam al-Mulk, prime minister of the Sultan when the Crusaders were still exerting themselves to conquer Jerusalem, was stabbed to death as he was being carried on his litter to the quarters of his women. The killer had approached him disguised as a dervish, and the Atabeg of Hims, guarded by a squad of men armed to the teeth, as he came down from his castle to go to Friday prayers, was slain by the old man's killers. Sinan decided to murder the Marquis Corrado di Montefeltro, a Christian, and readied two of his men, who introduced themselves among the infidels able to mimic their customs and language after much preparation. They had disguised themselves as monks, and while the Bishop of Tyre was entertaining the hapless Marquis at a banquet, leaped upon the victim and stabbed him. One assassin was immediately killed by the bodyguards. The other took refuge in a church, waited until the wounded man was brought there, attacked him again, finishing him off, then died blissfully. Blissfully because, as the Arab historiographers of the Sunni line and then the Christian chroniclers from Oderic of Pordenone to Marco Polo wrote, the old man had discovered a way to make his knights faithful even to the supreme sacrifice, to make them invincible, horrible war machines. He took them as youths, asleep, to the summit of the mountain, where he stupefied them with pleasures, wine, women, flowers, delectable banquets, and hashish, which gave the sect its name. When they could no longer do without the perverse delights of that invented paradise, he dragged them out of their sleep and set before them a choice. Go, kill, and if you succeed, this paradise you leave will again be yours, and forever, but if you fail, you will plunge back into the Gehenna of the everyday. Dazed by the drug, helpless before his demands, they sacrificed themselves in sacrificing others. They were killers destined to be killed, victims condemned to make victims. How they were feared! What tales the Crusaders told about them on moonless nights as the simoom howled over the desert! How the Templars admired, envied those splendid animals! How awed they were by the clear will to martyrdom! The Templars agreed to pay their tolls, asking in exchange formal tributes, in a game of reciprocal concessions, complicity, brotherhood of arms, disemboweling one another in the open field but embracing one another in secret, exchanging murmured words of mystical visions, magic formulas, alchemic subtleties. From the assassins, the Templars learned occult rites. It was cowardice and ignorance that kept King Philip's inquisitors from seeing that the spitting on the cross, the kiss on the anus, the black cat, and the worship of Baphomet
were simply a repetition of other ceremonies, ceremonies performed under the influence of the first secret the Templars learned in the Orient, the use of hashish. So it was obvious that the plan was born, had to be born, there. From the men of Alamut, the Templars learned of the subterranean currents. They met the men of Alamut in Provins and established the secret plot of the 36 Invisibles, and that is why Christian Rosenkreuz journeyed to Fez and other places in the Orient. And that is why it was to the Orient that Postel turned, and why it was from Egypt, home of the Fatimid Ismailis, that the mages of the Renaissance imported the eponymous divinity of the plan, Hermes, Hermes Teuth or Thoth, and why Egyptian figures were used by the mountebank Cagliostro for his rituals. And the Jesuits, less narrow than we had thought, with the good Father Kircher, lost no time in throwing themselves into hieroglyphics, Coptic, and the other Oriental languages, and Hebrew was only a cover, a nod to the fashion of the period. Chapter 104. These texts are not addressed to common mortals. Gnostic perception is a path reserved for an elite, for in the words of the Bible, do not cast your pearls before swine. Kamal Jumblatt, interview in Le Jour, March 31, 1967. Arcana publicata vilescunt, et gratiam profanata amituntur. Ergo, ne margaritas obice porcis, seu asino substerne rosas. Johann Valentin André, Die Chemische Hochzeit des Christian Rosenkreuz, Strasbourg, Zetzner, 1616, frontispiece. For that matter, where else could you find someone able to wait on the rock for six centuries, someone who had actually waited on the rock? True, Alamut eventually fell under the pressure of the Mongols, but the Ismaili sect survived throughout the East. It mingled with non-Shiite Sufism, it generated the terrible sect of the Druzes, and it survived, finally, among the Indian Khojas, the followers of the Aga Khan, not far from the site of Agartha. But I had discovered more. Under the Fatimid dynasty, through the Academy of Heliopolis, the hermetic notions of the ancient Egyptians were rediscovered in Cairo, and a House of Sciences was established there. House of Sciences? Was it from this that Bacon drew the inspiration for his House of Solomon, which in turn was the model for the Conservatoire? That's it, that's it! There's no doubt about it, Belbo said, intoxicated. But now how do the Kabbalists fit in? That's only a parallel story. The rabbis of Jerusalem sensed that something happened between the Templars and the Assassins, and the rabbis of Spain, snooping around under the pretense of lending money at interest to the European commanderies, get a whiff of something. They've been excluded, and spurred by national pride, they decide to figure it out on their own. What? We, the chosen people, are kept in the dark about the secret of secrets? And bang, the Kabbalistic tradition begins. A heroic attempt of the dispersed, the outsiders, to show up the masters, the ones in power, by claiming to know all. But doing that, they give the Christians the impression that they really do know all. And at a certain point, somebody makes the supreme goof, confusing Ismail with Israel. For God's sake, don't tell me that Barwell and the protocols and all the rest were simply the result of a misspelling. Kasaban, we're reducing a tragic chapter in history to a mistake of Pico della Mirandola. No, maybe there's another reason. The chosen people had taken on the duty of interpreting the book. People are afraid of those who make them look squarely at the law. But the assassins? Why didn't they turn up sooner? Belbo, think what a depressed area that was after the Battle of Lepanto. Sabatendorf knows that there is something to be learned from the Turk dervishes, but Alamut is no more. Those Turks are holed up God knows where. They wait. And finally their moment comes. On the tide of Islamic irredentism, they stick their heads out again. Putting Hitler in the plan, we found a good reason for the Second World War. Now, putting in the assassins of Alamut, we explain what has been happening for years in the Persian Gulf. And this is where we find a place for our trace. Templi resurgentes equites synarchici. A society whose aim is to heal the rift at last between the spiritual knighthoods of different faiths. Or else to stimulate conflict and take advantage of the confusion. Once again we've done our job and set history straight. Can it be that at the supreme moment the pendulum will reveal that the umbilicus mundi is at Alamut? Let's not go too far. I'd leave that last point hanging. Like the pendulum. If you like, we can't just say whatever enters our heads. No, no, strict scholarship above all.
That evening I congratulated myself on having invented a great tale. I was an aesthete who used the flesh and blood of the world to make beauty. But Belbo by now was an adept, and like other adepts, not through enlightenment, but faute de mieux.
Chapter 105. Claudicat ingenium, delirat lingua, labat mens. Lucretius, De Rerum Natura, Roman 3, 453.
It must have been about then that Belbo tried to take stock of what was happening to him, but the most severe self-analysis could not free him now from the sickness to which he had grown accustomed. File name, and what if it's true? To invent a plan. The plan justifies you to such a degree that you can no longer be held accountable, not even for the plan itself. Just throw the stone and hide your hand. If there really were a plan, there would be no failure. You never had Cecilia because the archons made Annibali Cantalamessa and Pio Bo unskilled even with the friendliest of the brass instruments. You fled the canal gang because the deckhands wanted to spare you for another holocaust. And the man with the scar has a talisman more powerful than yours. A plan, a guilty party, the dream of our species. An Deus sit. If he exists, it's his fault. The thing whose address I lost is not the end, it's the beginning. Not the object to be possessed, but the subject that possesses me. Misery loves company. Misery, company, too many dactyls. Nothing can dispel from my mind the most reassuring thought that this world is the creation of a shadowy god whose shadow I prolong. Faith leads to absolute optimism. I have committed fornication, true or not true, but God is the one unable to solve the problem of evil. Come, let us pound the fetus in the mortar with honey and pepper. Dieu le veut. If belief is absolutely necessary, let it be in a religion that doesn't make you feel guilty. A religion out of joint, fuming, subterranean, without an end, like a novel, not like a theology. Five paths to a single destination. What a waste. Better a labyrinth that leads everywhere and nowhere. To die with style, live in the Baroque. Only a bad demiurge makes us feel good. But if there is no cosmic plan, what a mockery to live in exile when no one sent you there. Exile from a place, moreover, that does not exist. And what if there is a plan, but it has eluded you, and will elude you for all eternity? When religion fails, art provides. You invent the plan, metaphor of the unknowable one. Even a human plot can fill the void. They didn't publish my Hearts in Ecstasy because I don't belong to the Templar clique. To live as if there were a plan, the Philosopher's Stone. If you can't beat them, join them. If there's a plan, adjust to it. Lorenza puts me to the test. Humility. If I had the humility to appeal to the angels, even without believing in them, and to draw the right circle, I would have peace. Maybe. Believe there is a secret and you will feel like an initiate. It costs nothing. To create an immense hope that can never be uprooted because it has no root. Ancestors who do not exist will never appear and say that you have betrayed. A religion you can keep while betraying it infinitely. Like André, to create in jest the greatest revelation of history and, while others are destroyed by it, swear for the rest of your life that you had nothing to do with it. To create a truth with a hazy outline, when somebody tries to clarify it, you excommunicate him. Accept only those hazier than yourself. Jamais donne mi à droite. Why write novels? Rewrite history. The history that then comes true. Why not set it in Denmark, Mr. William S.? Seven Seas Jim, Johann Valentin André, Luke Matthew, roams the archipelago of the Sunda between Patmos and Avalon, from the White Mountain to Mindanao, from Atlantis to Thessalonica to the Council of Nicaea. Origen cuts off his testicles and shows them, bleeding, to the fathers of the City of the Sun, and Hiram sneers filioque, filioque, while Constantine digs his greedy nails into the hollow eye sockets of Robert Flood. Death, death to the Jews of the ghetto of Antioch. Dieu est mon droit. Wave the Beaucian. Lay on, down with the Ophites and the Borborites, the snakes. Trumpets blare, and here comes the Chevalier Bienfaisant de la Cité Sainte, with the Moor's head bristling on their pike. The rebus, the rebus! Magnetic hurricane, the tower collapses. Rakowski grins over the roasted corpse of Jacques de Molay. I do not possess you, but I can blow up history. If the problem is this absence of being, and if what is what is said, then the more we talk, the more being there is. The dream of science is that there be little being, that it be concentrated and sayable, E equals MC squared. Wrong. To be saved at the very beginning, for all eternity, it is necessary for that being to be tangled, like a serpent tied into knots by a drunken sailor, impossible to untie. Invent, invent wildly, paying no attention to connections till it becomes impossible to summarize. A simple relay race among symbols, one says the name of the next without rest. To dismantle the world into a saraband of anagrams, endless, and then believe in what cannot be expressed. Is this not the true reading of the Torah? Truth is the anagram of an anagram. Anagrams equals Ars Magna. That must have been how it happened. Belbo decided to take the universe of the diabolical seriously, not because of an abundance of faith, but because of a total lack of it. Humiliated by his incapacity to create, and all his life he had dined out on his frustrated desires and his unwritten pages, the former a metaphor of the latter and vice versa, all full of his alleged impalpable cowardice, he came to realize that by inventing the plan, he had actually created. He fell in love with his golem, found it a source of consolation. Life, his life, mankind's, as art, and art as falsehood. Le monde est fait pour aboutir à un livre. Faux. But now he wanted to believe in this false book, because, as he had also written, if there was a plan, then he would no longer be defeated, diffident, a coward. And this is what finally happened. He used the plan, which he knew was unreal, to defeat a rival he believed real. And then, aware that the plan was mastering him as if it existed, or as if he, Belbo, and the plan were made of the same stuff, he went to Paris, toward a revelation, a liberation. Tormented by the daily remorse that for years and years he had lived only with ghosts of his own making, he was now finding solace in ghosts that were becoming objective, since they were known also to others, even though he was the enemy. Should he fling himself into the lion's maw? Yes, because the lion taking shape was more real than Seven Seas Jim, more real than Cecilia, more real perhaps than Lorenza Pellegrini herself. Belbo, sick from so many missed appointments, now felt able to make a real appointment. An appointment he could not evade from cowardice, because now his back was to the wall. Fear forced him to be brave. Inventing, he had created the principle of reality. Chapter 106. List number 5. 6 undershirts, 6 shorts, 6 handkerchiefs. Has always puzzled scholars, principally because of the total absence of socks. Woody Allen, The Metterling List, Getting Even, New York, Random House, 1966, page 8. It was during those days, no more than a month ago, that Leah decided a vacation would do me good. "You look tired," she said. Maybe the plan had worn me out. For that matter, the baby, as its grandparents said, needed clean air. Some friends lent us a house in the mountains. We didn't leave at once. There were things to attend to in Milan, and Leah said that nothing was more restful than taking a little vacation in the city when you knew you'd be going off on your real vacation. Now, for the first time, I talked to Leah about the plan. Until then, she had been too busy with the baby. She knew vaguely that Belbo, Diotalevi, and I were working on some puzzle, and that it occupied whole days and nights, but I hadn't said anything to her about it, not since the day she preached me that sermon about the psychosis of resemblances. Maybe I was ashamed. I described the whole plan to her, down to the smallest details, and told her about Diotalevi's illness, feeling guilty, as if I had done something wrong. I tried to present the plan for what it was, a display of bravura. Leah said, "Pau, I don't like your story." "Isn't it beautiful?" "The sirens were beautiful, too. Listen, what do you know about your unconscious?"
"Nothing. I'm not even sure I have one."
"There. Imagine that a Viennese prankster, to amuse his friends, invented the whole business of the id and Oedipus and made up dreams he had never dreamed and little Hanses he had never met. And what happened? Millions of people were out there, all ready and waiting to become neurotic in earnest, and thousands more ready to make money treating them."
"Leah, you're paranoid."
"Me? You?"
"Maybe we're both paranoid, but you have to grant me this. We started with the Ingolf document. It's natural, when one comes across a message of the Templars, to want to decipher it. Maybe we exaggerated a little to make fun of the decipherers of messages, but there was a message to begin with."
"All you know is what that Ardenti told you, and from your own description, he's an out-and-out fraud. Anyway, I'd like to see this message for myself."
"Nothing easier. I had it in my files." Leah took the paper, looked at it front and back, wrinkled her nose, brushed the hair from her eyes to see the first, the coated part, better. She said, "Is that all?"
"Isn't it enough for you?"
"More than enough. Give me 2 days to think about it."
When Leah asks for 2 days to think about something, she's determined to show me I'm stupid. I always accuse her of this, and she answers,
"If I know you're stupid, that means I love you even if you're stupid. You should feel reassured."
For 2 days, we didn't mention the subject again. Anyway, she was almost always out of the house. In the evening, I watched her huddled in a corner, making notes, tearing up one sheet of paper after another. When we got to the mountains, the baby scratched around all day in the grass. Leah fixed supper and ordered me to eat because I was thin as a rail. After supper, she asked me to fix her a double whiskey with lots of ice and only a splash of soda. She lit a cigarette, which she does only at important moments, told me to sit down, and then explained.
"Listen carefully, pal, because I'm going to demonstrate to you that the simplest explanation is always the best. Colonel Ardenti told you Ingolf found a message in Provence. I don't doubt that at all. Yes, Ingolf went down into the well and really did find a case with this text in it." And she tapped the French lines with her finger. "We are not told that he found a case studded with diamonds. All the colonel said was that according to Ingolf's notes, the case was sold. And why not? It was an antique. He may have made a little cash, but we are not told that he lived off the proceeds for the rest of his life. He must have had a small inheritance from his father."
"And why should the case be ordinary?"
"Because the message is ordinary. It's a laundry list. Come on, let's read it again.
A la, ellipsis, Saint-Jean, 36P Charette de Fin, 6, ellipsis, Entier avec Sayel, P, ellipsis, Les Blancs Montiax, R, ellipsis, S, ellipsis, Chevalier de Prouin pour la, ellipsis, J, N, C. 6 × 6 en 6 places, chacun fois 20 à, ellipsis, 120 à, ellipsis, Icet et l'ordination, al donjon le premier, I le second juste, Icieu, qui, ellipsis, pan, it al refuge, it à Notre-Dame de l'autre part de l'eau, it à l'hôtel des Publicains, it à la pierre, 3 × 6 avant la fête, ellipsis, la grand poutre.
A laundry list? For God's sake, didn't it ever occur to you to consult a tourist guide, a brief history of Provence? You discover immediately that the Grand Jodim, where the message was found, was a gathering place for merchants. Provence was a center for fairs in Champagne. And the Grange is on Rue Saint-Jean. In Provence, they bought and sold everything, but lengths of cloth were particularly popular. Drap, or dra, as they wrote it then, and every length was marked by a guarantee, a kind of seal. The second most important product of Provence was roses, red roses that the Crusaders had brought from Syria. They were so famous that when Edmund of Lancaster married Blanche d'Artois and took the title Comte de Champagne, he added the red rose of Provence to his coat of arms. Hence, too, the War of the Roses, because the House of York had a white rose as its symbol.
Who told you all this?
A little book of 200 pages published by the Tourist Bureau of Provence. I found it at the French Center. But that's not all. In Provence there's a fort known as the Donjon, which speaks for itself, and there is a Port au Pin, an Église du Refuge, various churches dedicated to Our Lady of this and that, a Rue de la Pierre Ronde, where there was a Pierre de Sang, a stone on which the Count's subjects set the coins of their tithes, and then a Rue des Blancs Manteaux, and a street called Le Grand Put Muse, for reasons not hard to guess. It was a street of brothels.
And what about the Publicans?
In Provence there had been some Cathars, who later were duly burned, and the Grand Inquisitor himself was a converted Cathar, Robert Le Bougre. So it's hardly strange that a street or an area should be called the place of the Cathars, even if the Cathars weren't there anymore.
Still, in 1344...
But who said this document dates from 1344? Your colonel read 36 years after the Haywain, but in those days a pea made in a certain way with a tail meant post, but a pea without the tail meant pro. The author of this text is an ordinary merchant who made some notes on business transacted at the Grange, or rather on the Rue Saint-Jean, and he recorded a price of 36 sous, or crowns, or whatever denomination it was, for one or each wagon of hay.
And the 120 years?
Who said anything about years?
Ingolf found something he transcribed as 120A.
What is an A?
I checked in a list of abbreviations used in those days and found that for denier or denarium, odd signs were used. One looks like a delta, another looks like a theta, a circle broken on the left. If you write it carelessly and in haste, as a busy merchant might, a fanatic like Colonel Ardenti could take it for an A, having already read somewhere the story of the 120 years. You know where better than I. He could have read it in any history of the Rosicrucians. The point is, he wanted to find something resembling post centum viginti annos potabo.
And then what does he do?
He finds it repeated several times, and he reads it as iterum.
But the abbreviation for iterum was ITM, whereas IT means item, which means likewise, and is in fact used for repetitious lists.
Our merchant is calculating how much he's going to make on the orders he's received, and he's listing the deliveries he has to make. He has to deliver some bouquets of roses of Provins, and that's the meaning of R ellipsis S ellipsis, Chevalier de Provins. And where the colonel read Vengeance, because he had the Cadoche Knights on his mind, you should read Jonchée. The roses were used to make either hats or floral carpets on feast days. So here is how your Provins message should read. In Rue Saint-Jean, 36 sous for wagons of hay, 6 new lengths of cloth with seal to Rue des Blancs-Manteaux. Crusaders' roses to make a jonchée, 6 bunches of 6 in the 6 following places, each 20 deniers, making 120 deniers in all. Here is the first. The first to the fort, item the second to those in Fort au Pin, item to the Church of the Refuge, item to the Church of Notre Dame across the river, item to the old building of the Cathars, item to Rue de la Pierre Ronde, and 3 bunches of 6 before the feast in the Horse Street.
Because they too, poor things, maybe wanted to celebrate the feast day by making themselves nice little hats of roses.
My God, I said, I think you're right.
Of course I'm right. It's a laundry list, I tell you.
Wait a minute. This may very well be a laundry list, but the first message really is in code, and it talks about 36 invisibles.
True. The French text I polished off in an hour, but the other one kept me busy for 2 days. I had to examine Tritanius at both the Ambrosiana and the Trivulziana, and you know what the librarians there are like. Before they let you put your hands on an old book, they look at you as if you were planning to eat it. But the first message, too, is a simple matter. You should have discovered this yourself. To begin with, are you sure that les temps six invisibles séparés en six bandes is in the same French as our merchants?
Yes. This expression was used in a 17th-century pamphlet when the Rosicrucians appeared in Paris.
But then you reason the way your diabolicals do. If the message is encoded according to the method of Tritanius, it means that Tritanius copied from the Templars, and since it quotes a sentence that was current in Rosicrucian circles, it means that the plan attributed to the Rosicrucians was none other than the plan of the Templars. Try reversing the argument, as any sensible person would. Since the message is written in Tritanius's code, it was written after Tritanius, and since it quotes an expression that circulated among the 17th-century Rosicrucians, it was written after the 17th century. So at this point, what is the simplest hypothesis? Ingolf finds the Provins message. Since, like the colonel, he's an enthusiast of hermetic messages, he sees 36 and 120 and thinks immediately of the Rosicrucians. And since he's also an enthusiast of cryptography, he amuses himself by putting the Provins message into code as an exercise. So he translates his fine Rosicrucian sentence using a Tritanius cryptosystem.
An ingenious explanation, but it's no more valid than the colonel's.
So far, no. But suppose you make one conjecture, then a second, and a third, and they all support one another. Already you're more confident that you're on the right track, aren't you? I began with the suspicion that the words used by Ingolf were not the ones taken from Tritanius. They're in the same Kabbalistic Assyrio-Babylonian style, but they're not the same. Yet if Ingolf had wanted words beginning with the letters that interested him, in Tritanius he could have found as many as he liked. Why didn't he use those words?
Well, why didn't he?
Maybe he needed specific letters also in the second, third, and fourth positions. Maybe our ingenious Ingolf wanted a multi-coded message. Maybe he wanted to be smarter than Tritanius. Tritanius suggests 40 major cryptosystems. In one, only the initial letters count. In another, the first and third letters. In another, every other initial letter, and so on. Until, with a little effort, you can invent 100 more systems on your own. As for the 10 minor cryptosystems, the Colonel considered only the first wheel, which is the easiest. But the following ones work on the principle of the second wheel. Here's a copy of it for you. Imagine that the inner circle is mobile, and you can turn it so that the letter A coincides with any letter of the outer circle. You will have one system where A is written as X, another where A is U, and so on. With 22 letters on each circle, you can produce not 10, but 21 cryptosystems. The 22nd is no good, because there A is A. Don't tell me that for each letter of each word you tried all 21 systems. I had brains on my side, and luck. Since the shortest words have 6 letters, it's obvious that only the first 6 are important and the rest are just for looks. Why 6 letters? Supposing Golf coded the first letter, then skipped one, then coded the third, then skipped 2, and coded the 6th. For the first letter I used wheel number 1, for the third letter I used wheel number 2, and got a sentence. Then I tried wheel number 3 for the 6th letter and got a sentence again. I'm not saying Ingolf didn't use other letters too, but 3 positive results are enough for me. If you want to, you can take it further. Don't keep me in suspense. What came out? Look at the message again. I've underlined the letters that count. Now, we know what the first message is. It's the one about the 36 invisibles. Now, listen to what comes out if you substitute the third letters using the second wheel. Chambre des demoiselles, l'aiguille creuse. But I know that. It's en aval d'entretat, la chambre des demoiselles, sous le fort du Fré-Fossé, aiguille creuse. The message deciphered by Arsène Lupin when he discovers the secret of the hollow peak. You remember that entretat, at the edge of the beach, stands the aiguille creuse, a natural castle, habitable inside, the secret weapon of Julius Caesar when he invaded Gaul, and later used by the kings of France. The source of Lupin's immense power. And you know how lupinologists are crazy about this story. They make pilgrimages to Entretat, they look for secret passages, they make anagrams of every word of Leblanc. Ingolf was no less a lupinologist than he was a Rosicrucianologist, and so code after code. My diabolicals could always argue that the Templars knew the secret of the peak, and therefore the message was written in Provence in the 14th century. Of course I realize that. But now comes the third message. Third wheel applied to the 6th letter of each word. Listen. Merde, j'en ai marre de cette steganographie. And this is modern French. The Templars didn't talk like that. Shit, I'm sick of this hermetic writing. That's how Ingolf talked. And having given himself a headache coding all this nonsense, he got a final kick cursing in code what he was doing. But he was not without shrewdness. Notice that each of these 3 messages has 36 letters. Poor pal, Ingolf was having fun, just like the 3 of you, and that imbecile colonel took him seriously. Then why did Ingolf disappear? Who says he was murdered? Ingolf got fed up living in Auxerre, seeing nobody but the pharmacist and the spinster daughter who whined all day. So maybe he went to Paris, pulled off a good deal selling one of his old books, found himself a buxom and willing widow, and started a new life. Like those men who go out to buy cigarettes and the wives never see them again. And the colonel? Didn't you tell me that not even the detective is sure they killed him? He got into some jam, his victims tracked him down, and he took to his heels. Maybe at this very moment he's selling the Eiffel Tower to an American tourist and going under the name DuPont. I couldn't give in all along the line. All right, we started out with a laundry list. Yet we were clever enough, inventive enough, to turn a laundry list into poetry. Your plan isn't poetic, it's grotesque. People don't get the idea of going back to burn Troy just because they read Homer. With Homer, the burning of Troy became something that it never was and never will be, and yet the Iliad endures, full of meaning, because it's all clear, limpid. Your Rosicrucian manifestos are neither clear nor limpid. They're mud, hot air, and promises. This is why so many people have tried to make them come true, each finding in them what he wants to find. In Homer there's no secret, but your plan is full of secrets, full of contradictions. For that reason, you could find thousands of insecure people ready to identify with it. Throw the whole thing out. Homer wasn't faking, but you 3 have been faking. Beware of faking. People will believe you.
People believe those who sell lotions that make lost hair grow back. They sense instinctively that the salesman is putting together truths that don't go together, that he's not been logical, that he's not speaking in good faith. But they've been told that God is mysterious, unfathomable. So to them, incoherence is the closest thing to God. The far-fetched is the closest thing to a miracle. You've invented hair oil. I don't like it. It's a nasty joke. This disagreement didn't spoil our weeks in the mountains. I took long walks, read serious books, became closer to the child than I'd ever been. But between me and Leah, there was something left unsaid. On the one hand, she had put me in a tight corner and was sorry to have humiliated me. On the other, she wasn't convinced that she had convinced me. Indeed, I felt a pull to the plan. I didn't want to abandon it. I had lived with it too long. A few days ago, I got up early to catch the one train for Milan, and in Milan I received Belvo's call from Paris, and I began this story, which for me is not yet finished. Leah was right. We should have talked about it earlier, but I wouldn't have believed her all the same. I had experienced the creation of the plan like the moment of Tiferet, the heart of the Sephirotic body, the harmony of rule and freedom. Theo Talevi had told me that Moses Cordovero warned, "He who, because of his Torah, becomes proud over the ignorant, that is, over the whole people of Yahweh, leads Tiferet to grow proud over Malkut." But what Malkut is, the kingdom of this earth, in its dazzling simplicity, is something I understand only now, in time to grasp the truth, perhaps too late to survive the truth. Leah, I don't know if I will see you again. If not, the last image I have of you is half asleep under the blankets a few days ago. I kissed you that morning and hesitated before I left.